the previous lecture, we spent at least a little bit of time in cantos 1, 2, 3, and 4. However, we are not going to mention, at least in any detail, most of the cantos from here on. That is to say, what we're going to be doing is looking at representative cantos in each of the major parts of hell, and then we'll talk about purgatory and heaven later on. But in doing this, spending more time analyzing less, what we want to do is be able to provide you with some tools so that you will be better readers on your own of the other parts. We want to make sure that you have a chance to explore Dante, not just with us, but also on your own. And so as we enter into the second circle, one of four circles in the category of sin called incontinence, we're first going to meet up with those who are called the lustful. And in doing so, we're going to have one of the most dramatic encounters of the entire Commedia, one that has been talked about, written about, and a lot of music has been composed about, and that is the meeting between Dante and Francesca and Paolo. But first, something about how we enter into this particular section of the Inferno.
Well, it's sort of interesting that here, when we're in hell without any asterisks whatsoever, the first thing that we see is that it's got a judge, and the judge is there to give people their appropriate place in the afterlife. The monster, classical monster Minos, that Dante takes and puts here, he sort of rings his tail around himself the number of times that he wants to send a sinner down. So six rings, you go down to the sixth circle. And sort of as the guardian of hell in general, we know that we're in it big time after we get there. But it's sort of interesting to see what we get to when we pass by Minos and are now ready to have this, as Bill said, sustained encounter with the lustful. What we get is a very interesting sort of geography presented to us. We've already mentioned the fact that we're likely to have a physical geography, which is at the same time a kind of moral geography. It's sort of nifty to see the way that works in what you get as the sort of placement of the lustful, because geography is very much implicated in the punishment for the sin here.
We discover that the sinners are sort of blowing around in an infernal storm, to use Dante's phrase in line 31 of Canto 5. They're sort of blowing around, and what's interesting is that therefore every puff and gust of wind sort of bumps them up and down and around. They're totally out of control. Wherever any air current, if you will, takes them, that's where they go. In fact, Dante likens them to birds that we still see in Italy who lay their wings out in the evening, and therefore, as you looked at them, it looks like they're sort of nice and smooth and floating, but they'll in fact constantly be bumping because, of course, they will be taken up and down by every single little bitty air pocket.
So this is one of the best places, pretty close to the beginning, to see the way in which the punishment is a reflection of the sin. The word that Bill used that I think is the one that kind of should key our attention is out of control, because, of course, it's the nature of the sin itself to be out of control. That's a sort of as good a definition, or at least as good a modern definition of lust as you might want to find. And so you get this very interesting picture, literally, of sinners in the afterlife getting what they wanted back on earth. And that's a very important part of the system of Dante's hell. To give sinners in the afterlife, you get what you want. They want it to be out of control, and that's what they get. Notice the language. As wings of starling in the winter bear them along in widespread crowded flocks, so does that wind propel the evil spirits. Now here, then there, and up and down it drives them, with never any hope to comfort them, hope not of rest, but even of suffering less. And so it's sort of this flock of birds who turn out not to be birds at all, but souls buffeted by the wind. They are the lustful, and there's a whole mess of them there. And the technique here that the poet uses is very interesting and very instructive for the way he works throughout. You'll see a lot of sinners. They're identified. Then we concentrate on just a couple of them, and then we concentrate even more on one sinner, as Bill said, the famous Francesca da Rimini, whose story Dante gets to hear in great detail. So we go from geography to sort of the group picture, and then from a group picture to a sort of small group photo, and then from the small group photo to the dramatic dialogue, the dramatic interchange between Dante and an inhabitant of the afterlife. And since this is the first sustained encounter between Dante and a permanent inhabitant of the afterlife, for that reason, too, it's worth our attention, because it tells us not only about the nature of this particular sin, it also tells us a whole lot about how to read the Inferno, what to look for, what the kind of characteristic ploys of the sinners are, and so on down a very long list.
This introduction around that Dante receives really is a pretty interesting cast of characters. For example, we find Cleopatra. That may not be much of a surprise. We find the great hero Achilles. One of the most important figures we find, this would be in line 61, the next is she who killed herself for love and broke faith with the ashes of Sychaeus. You may recall this is a person we've already mentioned a couple times. It's a way of showing how the introductory material is going to make reading the Inferno a little bit more meaningful, because we talked about her, she is Dido, as a character in the Aeneid, in fact sort of the dominant character along with Aeneas in Book 4, and then we talked about her again when we went to the Confessions of St. Augustine and talked about how Augustine tells of reading the story in the Aeneid of Dido. Now we know where Dido's own place is in the afterlife, and Dante, although he will not converse with Dido, mentions her a couple times, and therefore really is reminding us that we need to cash in on what we know about the whole catalog of stories and interpretations of Dido in order fully to understand what he's doing here.
And in fact, Dido is one of the characters in this particular canto who sort of provides us with a kind of signature to it. It's in a way, it becomes of course Francesca's canto, but in a way it's Dido's canto as well, because when Dante wants to find this one particular pair of sinners to talk to, notice what he says. I raised my voice to them, O wearied souls, come speak with us if it is not forbidden. As doves called by desire to return to their sweet nest, with wings raised high and poised, float downward through the air, guided by will. So these two left the flock where Dido is. In other words, this is sort of Dido's flock in a very real way. But in any case, what happens is that you have these two sinners leave the flock, come to Dante, and we have then the first sustained encounter between the pilgrim and a figure from the afterlife. And it's interesting that it is the figure who begins speaking first. She speaks to Dante before Dante speaks to her.
O living creature, gracious and so kind, who makes your way here through this dingy air to visit us, who stained the world with blood, and so on. What an odd way to begin. O living creature. Not hey fella, or anything else. But in fact, the Italian word is animal, A-N-I-M-A-L. We, of course, use it to mean mammals and all that sort of stuff. The word literally means, oh, animated thing, oh, living thing, thing with an anima, a soul. Why would she refer to him by this very generic word rather than recognize his humanity? Well, if we think about the sin of incontinence, the sin of incontinence is the sin of ignoring, sort of rejecting, putting aside, not using the specifically human gifts of intellect and will. That's what she's done. That's why she's here. And therefore, just as it's gone in her, she does not recognize Dante's humanity. She does not recognize what it is that makes Dante specifically a human being. So from the very first words that Francesca speaks, she's telling us much more than she thinks she's telling us about herself. And that will remain true as long as she speaks in Inferno 5.
In fact, in that very same line, she turns to Dante and she says, gracious and so kind. Well, what she's saying to Dante is, you have done me a really special favor of coming down to hell to pay a little social call. Well, we have to remember, we have to remind ourselves that, again, it's a really good example of what Bill said about Francesca's point of view not being ours. The fact is, Dante's not there to pay a social call to Francesca. He's there because this is a last-ditch, final attempt to do something that will get him out of this deep, deep spiritual malaise. This is what you do when nothing else is going to work. This is a kind of shock treatment for the soul that Dante is getting. And yet she looks upon it as though this is a kind of out-of-the-way and fairly extravagant social call. You've come all the way to see me. Well, what that indicates pretty clearly is that, like every other soul that we encounter in the Inferno, Francesca fully and completely believes that she is the exact center of the universe. And everything is seen in relation to that centrality. Notice, for example, she also says, if we could claim as friend the King of Kings, you know, if it happened that we were on speaking terms with God, then we would ask him that he grant you peace. We're not, as though, once again, this is some sort of minor social tiff that they're having that will be fixed up sooner or later. But again, that sense of total disregard for where she is, a kind of oblivion to what it means to be down there, and seeing things merely in terms of a set of social relations. Notice also that she's speaking, this would be medieval language as much as modern, with great courtesy and elegance, as though courtesy and elegance were really all you need to get on in life. And indeed, when she tells her story, or as she continues to tell her story, that courtesy and that elegance is sort of the dominant picture that we get as she continues.
Let's take a look at the way she begins to explain the story of her life, specifically the story of the end of her life. Love, quick to kindle in the gentle heart, sees this one, Paolo, next to her, for the beauty of my body torn from me. How it happens still offends me. Love, that excuses no one love from loving, seized me so strongly with delight in him that, as you see, he never leaves my side. Love led us straight to sudden death together. Notice what she's doing here. We were teaching this story once inside a prison, and we were reading that passage. One of the inmates put up his hand and said, "That's me. That's why I'm here." That is to say, he went on to explain to us, I used to do that all the time. I'd do something wrong, and I'd find something else to blame for it. I would never look at myself as the cause of the problem. And listen to Francesca's language again. Love seized me. Love seized me. Love led us. She creates this personification of love, a certain kind of love, of course, and then she says, love made me do it. I had no choice. I had no control over my own self. This is something that love forced us to do.
Now notice that in doing that, in putting the blame on love, she's making love sound like a kind of independent being, another kind of animal, if you will, another kind of being with a soul. And in personifying love, it is therefore able to shift the blame. Okay, as though love were there with an AK-47 saying, you will do what I tell you. And in so doing, Spill says, she's the first to sort of shift the blame somewhere else. But what she's also doing is using a kind of language that poets in Dante's own time used in their own love poetry, and indeed not all that different from the language of Dante's own earlier love poetry. So Francesca sort of sounds like a character from a Harlequin romance if we're using modern categories, but if we're using somewhat older categories, she sounds a little bit like characters that you might read about in the poetry of Dante's youth. And I think this is extremely important, because when Dante responds to her, one of the things that he does is respond with an enormous amount of pity. It's almost as though Francesca's story moves him so deeply because it's a story, if not actually about himself, about the kind of stuff that he also was used to writing. So there's something very personal here, and it speaks toward the fact that when Dante has long conversations with sinners, it's almost always because those sinners have something special to tell him. In other words, it's almost as though what he's seeing in these sinners are kind of mirrors of aspects or part of his own life. And so, in a sense, what he has to do is learn from these sinners how to overcome those same tendencies in his own life. But, of course, right now, at the beginning, hardly at all removed from the dark wood of error, his tendency rather is to sympathize with them. Instead of, listening and saying, my goodness, what a crock is this? He is enormously affected and moved by it, so affected and so moved that, in fact, he wants to hear a whole lot more about what's going on. Alas, again, Dante's the one who's speaking, all those sweet thoughts and, oh, how much desiring brought you two down into this agony. He's hooked, okay? If this is a harlequin romance, maybe it's also a kind of soap opera, and he can't wait to get to the next episode. And so he asks Francesca, tell me more about this. Tell me how it happened in really excruciating detail.
And as it turns out, both up to now and in the story she's about to tell more elaborately, she leaves out some things. Now, obviously, whenever we tell a story, we make certain decisions about what we say. But we've got Francesca with this guy, Paolo, in an area where the lustful are being punished. Here's a detail she leaves out. She's married, but not to Paolo. That's fairly important. Number two, Paolo is the brother of her husband. That is to say, she's there with her brother-in-law in this sort of barren embrace as they're being whirled around. Those are sort of important facts to know. It sort of helps us to understand who Francesca is. She leaves them out. And we have them in a translation like this because they're in the notes. That's why looking at notes at least occasionally is a useful thing to do. Because you cannot trust these sinners to tell you the whole story. They tell you what they want you to hear because they think in some way it will justify their position.
And, of course, in this particular case, this was a kind of well-known, our phrase would be tabloid story from a little bit before Dante's time. He's aware of who she is in the middle of this story. This was, if not front page news, back page news on whatever the Italian equivalent of the National Enquirer would be. And, in fact, the other detail is that they were caught in the act by her husband, her lover's brother, who killed them on the spot. And that's sort of what gets them to where they are here. And so in leaving all of that out, she's not only leaving out stuff that Dante's audience would have been well aware of, but leaving out all of the things that might ask us to take a moral stance here. I mean, jeepers, what about doing it with your husband's brother? But again, her language is just simply, hey, it was love. Love made us do it. And then, as she gets even more specific, when Dante says, well, how did love enable you to recognize your dubious desires? How did this stuff start? Her story is even more ingenious in some ways because of the really wonderful way in which she's able to put off the blame yet once again.
One day, we read, to pass the time away, of Lancelot, of how he fell in love. We were alone, innocent of suspicion. Okay. There are a lot of things here we need to think about. First of all, she and her brother-in-law were alone, and they had a book, a very famous story, the story of Lancelot, the story of the Round Table. We need to ask ourselves for a minute, what is the basic lesson, or at least a basic lesson, of that whole story? I suppose one way to summarize it is when one of your knights is having an affair with your wife, one of the king's wife is having an affair with a knight, when that's happening, it's sort of hard to have the round table. Sort of hard to work out how you keep Camelot. And so, if you will, there are very important moral lessons to be learned in that story, despite the fact the story has a lot of romance and intrigue and excitement in it. Well, how would you find that moral lesson? Or to put it another way as a question, would you find it if you read the book simply to pass the time away?
One of the ways that we update it is to sort of suggest that the modern equivalent would be to say, let's, you know, jump on the waterbed and put maybe an R-rated, but, you know, R to X-rated video in the VCR and pass the time away and see, well, maybe anything's going to happen, but it's really all innocent. Because, in other words, when she says to pass the time away, in Italian, the phrase is even more pointed. The phrase is per diletto, which when I do my translation of the commedia, I'm going to translate as one day we read four kicks. Okay? It's kind of the equivalent of in my youth when censorship laws were a lot stronger than they are now, and, you know, the class was passing around the secret version of Lady Chatterley's Lover. You'd already know what the good passages were because they were all dog-eared. Okay, you wouldn't have to read the book. You could just go to the smut. Well, essentially, what she seems to be doing is reading it not for the moral, but reading it as a kind of how-to manual. Okay, she's reading it, in other words, for instruction, as she tells us immediately after. She's reading in the book, and then time and again, well, first of all, that wonderful line, we were alone, innocent of suspicion. I think it's a valid question to ask whether you can be reading this sort of a book alone with your brother's, with your husband's brother, and be innocent of suspicion. But even if you were willing to give her the benefit of the doubt there, which I think most certainly we don't want to do, take a look at what she says immediately afterwards. Time and again, our eyes were brought together by the book we read. Well, at this point, are we still to say they were without any kind of suspicion? And then our faces flushed and paled. To the moment of one line alone, we yielded. It was when we read about those longed-for lips now being kissed by such a famous lover. Well, again, she doesn't necessarily want us to get this out of what she's saying, but it's hard not to. They're using it as a kind of how-to manual. We look and see what they're doing in the book. We imitate it ourselves. And again, notice that she's saying that it was the book that brought us to that, and she even says that in more explicit detail as the text goes on.
She goes on to say, "Then he kissed my mouth and trembled as he did. Our Gallaho was that book, and he who wrote it." Well, Gallaho is, of course, a character in the Lancelot story, the go-between between Guinevere and Lancelot. In fact, in some terms, the term Gallaho can mean a kind of pimp, the one that makes all the arrangements, the procurer, if you will. And so here she says it's the book that did it. She's already said love did it. Okay, love made us do this. Love seized us. Love led us and whatever. Now it's the book did it. It's the book's fault. And, well, there's plenty of blame, and she's passing it all around, and it seems to belong every place but on Francesca. And it's very important to see that if you think about what are the ultimate consequences of saying love did it or the book did it, it is I have no freedom of the will. I have no faculty of choosing. I'm simply being manipulated by these impersonal forces, whether it's love or whether it's a particular book. And it's very easy for Dante the Pilgrim, for the reader, to buy into that. It's going to take a very careful reader to see how Francesca is speaking to us and how we should respond to it.
Notice that Francesca's position here is that, again, as Bill said, I didn't really make a choice. This stuff kind of happened to me, and, you know, the book made me do it just as love did. Well, in that sense, having kind of given over her freedom of the will, that's reflected in the punishment. We can now kind of go back and think about her being blown all around as somebody who has given up will and freedom. It's kind of nifty, again, to see how the moral geography of the poem operates as part of the punishment. Notice also that when she's saying, I really had no choice, love called, I answered, the book says, hey, do it, I did it, she also is, in a way, reenacting that in the very story that she's telling to Dante here. What I mean by that is simply this. Dante says, hey, you know, tell me a little bit more about how this all happened. And Francesca says, well, you know, there's no greater pain than to remember in our present grief past happiness. But if this is your desire, I'll certainly do it. In other words, Dante is asking her to do something that ultimately is going to cause her a great deal of pain, and she's willing to because she seems to be a girl who just can't say no. And what she did back on Earth is now duplicated, replicated in the position that she's in hell here. Okay, so she responds to Dante's call and does something which is ultimately bringing her pain. Well, notice that that, too, is a very good definition of what Dante, the poet, means by sin, doing something that ultimately is destructive. Here, as in so many of the other examples that we see, the person who is most harmed by any particular sin, by every sin in hell, is the sinner primarily, others secondarily. And Francesca illustrates this in a particularly vivid way. She's not done yet.
The punchline, the last line she speaks, in fact, in the encounter with Dante, this is line 138. That day, we read no further. One passage, one kiss, put the book down. Well, the obvious question to ask is why? And I think the answer is pretty obvious, because they went right into the old sackaroo together. And of course, while they were in the sack together, her husband, Paolo's brother, comes home and kills them both. So it's an interesting line that tells us what this story has really been leading to all along. We sort of knew it. She knows it. But at any rate, she tries to tell it differently. But what's interesting is that line is virtually a quotation of the story of another person who was affected by lust, a fella named St. Augustine.
As it turns out, we talked a little bit in a previous lecture about the importance of Book 8 in the Confessions, where Augustine is converted. Augustine is converted by reading a book. And the book that he's reading is by Paul, St. Paul. Francesca here, of course, her lover is Paul, Paolo in Italian. And in both cases, what happens is that they take up a book and read it. Augustine is told by the voice of a child to take the book and read. He picks up Paul. Paul tells him to give up his lust in particular, but all manner of unseemly revelry. And he says at that moment, okay, that day I read no further, nor was there need. In other words, at that exact moment, Augustine was converted. His will turned from the self toward God. What Dante is doing is taking that passage, echoing it here to show how in Francesca, exactly the same thing happens, but in exactly the opposite direction. As Augustine is turned from self to God, Francesca is turned from God to self through Paolo. And what we see is that, as in Augustine, this is the moment when his will enters into the conversion, when he chooses. This is Dante's wonderfully subtle way of saying that Francesca, too, despite all of her claims to the contrary, despite all of this stuff about saying love made me do it and the book made me do it, turns her will, makes a choice, and of course here has to live with the consequences of that choice. Okay? Now, it's interesting also, if you take a look at that day we read no further line in another way, Bill is giving you all the reasons why they weren't reading any further, and of course, they didn't read much further because they got to the sack, and then they got to the sack, and then they got killed. Okay? Husband comes in, catches them in the act, kills them right there in the spot. A little bit earlier, when Francesca was talking all about how love did this and love did that, and love was so powerful, and I couldn't help myself, the final punchline of that little speech in favor of love, love led us straight to sudden death together, Caina awaits the one who quenched our lives. Caina is one of the places that Dante has at the very, very bottom of hell for folks who are guilty of treachery. And what Francesca is saying is that SOB who killed us is going to get his. Now, whether or not that's true, we have no way of knowing. For all we know, husband repented. Francesca, I don't think, has any special insight here. But the deal is, Francesca's talking all this sweet talk about love, 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 it's so wonderful. And the last line, the punchline, is hate for the SOB who did it to me. Well, one way of taking a look at that is that's a pretty narrow way of thinking about love. Okay, that the love that she's talking about actually turns out to be so narrowly focused that it's only about herself.
After Dante hears this story, he faints. Dante the pilgrim just collapses and faints. It's such a sad story. It grips him so that he just can't stand it. I think what we can say as our final take on this canto is, Dante, you got a lot of learning left to do. It's only Canto 5. You got a ways to go. And we'll pick up the story shortly after this event happens.